Welcome to Studio Tulsa on Health. I'm John Schumann, sitting in for Rich Fisher. The Nobel Prizes were awarded recently to the usual week of fanfare over the recipients and their work. Over its century-plus history, the Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine has been awarded a half dozen times to scientists who have made discoveries in the field of immunology. Immunology is the field of medicine focused on biologic organisms and the response to challenges from the external environment. In human medicine, we think of our immune system as that which patrols our tissues and keeps us healthy when we are afflicted with pathogenic organisms, such as bacteria or viruses, or other forms of disease. Crucial to the understanding of our immune system is the concept of self versus non-self. That is, how do our infection-fighting cells know when to wreak havoc on invaders and when they should lay in repose and surveillance? The whole self-non-self issue is most relevant in the world of transplant. We all have a general idea that we can't simply take a kidney from anyone and have it placed in our bodies. It must on some level match. It's our immune system, indeed our compatibility genes, that determine whether or not we are a tissue match for each other. A new book called The Compatibility Gene by Daniel M. Davis has been released from Oxford University Press, and it explores both the history of immunology and several arresting concepts and experiments in the field that are very accessible to a lay reader. Davis is the director of research at the University of Manchester's Collaborative Center for Inflammation Research. Aside from more than 100 academic papers, he's written articles for Nature, Science, and Scientific American. Daniel Davis is my guest today over the phone from his home in Manchester, England. Professor Dan Davis, welcome to Studio Tulsa on Health.
Hi, how are you doing?
I just want to say, first of all, that it's quite a book, and for those that are interested in science literature, it reminded me a bit of an award-winning book of a few years ago, The Emperor of Maladies, about cancer by Siddhartha Mukherjee. And what I like about this book is not only does it explain research and current thinking about the immunology field, but it also is sort of a breathtaking history of the whole field. And you managed to accomplish that in a relatively concise book.
Right. So, well, first of all, you know, thanks for putting me in the same category as The Emperor of Maladies, which is, of course, an outstanding book. So that's right. So, you know, one of my aims in this book was to give this sense of a sort of sweeping adventure of how science really gets done over, you know, I cover about 60 years. And I try to show that what one of the themes that maybe comes across through that is that it isn't all instant eureka moments that lead to a changing our understanding of something. But actually, there's lots of scientists digging away in their own world, in their own details of what they're working on. And only when you put all those details together does the big picture emerge, and that big picture is a revolution.
Right. In fact, many of these scientists you write about, weren't collaborating or weren't even aware of each other's work.
Right. So there's lots of stories of, you know, I start off the book with scientists working in Oxford, and their experiments fit very well with ideas of another scientist who's working in Australia. And so from Oxford, UK, over to Australia is opposite sides of the world. And yet when you put those experiments from Oxford with the ideas that people had in Australia, you get a fantastic insight into a new aspect of how the body works.
So for the lay audience here, we'll ask you the hard challenge. Tell us, what is immunology, or what, you know, how do you conceptualize the immune system?
The immune system is basically, when we're trying to understand the immune system, we're trying to understand how your body recognizes and fights off disease, which could be germs or cancerous cells or other things that trigger damage to your body. So in trying to understand that, one of the principles by which the immune system works is that it recognizes all the bits of you, all the parts of you, yourself, and then it, in effect, attacks anything that's not part of you, which in the jargon might be called non-self. So one of the principles, you could say, by which the immune system works is that it discriminates between self, everything that's part of you, and non-self, everything that's not part of you. And understanding how that works in detail is what the study of immunology, I guess, is about.
And so the title, The Compatibility Gene, really comes from this concept of histocompatibility, that is, tissues being compatible with one another. And there are these molecular signatures or keys that our bodies, or I guess the bodies of all organisms to some extent, produce that allow us to recognize self as non-self. Is that fair to say?
Right. So the compatibility genes are central in their genes are used by your body to identify what is part of itself so that it knows not to attack any of the cells in you that have your own particular genes. and it will recognize anything else as non-self. So that's, in fact, how these genes were discovered. These genes were discovered because in transplant situations, your body would attack the transplant from somebody else because it's not self, and then that attack occurs because they have different versions of these compatibility genes. So in effect, these compatibility genes are a molecular identification of what is you, of yourself. And that's because these genes are, in fact, the genes that differ the most from person to person. So that's how, if everyone has slightly different versions of these genes, that's how your body is able to know what's part of you and recognize that other cells are not part of you, because everybody has different versions of these genes. So these are the genes that differ the most from person to person. So out of all the 25,000 genes that make up the human genome, we all have very similar genes, but you have a few, there are some differences. For example, genes that give you different hair color, eye color, skin color. But the genes that differ the most from one person to the next are these genes, the compatibility genes. They're not genes that control anything physically different like hair color or eye color. They're these genes, these immune system genes, are the genetic differences, the greatest genetic differences between individual people.
And how many are we talking about in terms of compatibility genes of the 25,000 in our human genome?
So it's slightly complicated. So there are thousands of different versions of the genes, and it's slightly complicated. So there are actually class 1, class 2, class 3 genes. Yeah, there's a whole bunch of jargon. So it's an easy way to get across the variety. So out of a handful of like 6 of these genes, then in a database of 18 million people, there were only 4 people that had versions of the genes similar to mine. So out of 18 million for these just 6 genes, then 4 people had versions similar to me. So they're not quite unique, but they're close to being unique for each individual person.
So we can see the challenge then in something like transplant biology. So if I needed a kidney and I'm going to want somebody who's a match of 6 antigens, right? Because you were mentioning this histocompatibility type 1. Really, there's only really 6 variables. Is that right? 6 variants?
Right.
And so I guess we now know if we can find those matches, but the barrier then to some of the science would be how to overcome those that aren't complete matches. Is that safe to say?
So Peter Medawar, who won the Nobel Prize for his work in this area of transplantation, he was switched on to this problem that you have to somehow overcome the problem with transplantation. So actually, when he was sitting in a garden in Oxford University, there was a plane crash down the road, and he was called in to look at the burnt airmen in the War Wounds Hospital in Oxford. And there, they were doing skin grafts to try to help these burnt victims. And he could see that there was this clear problem, like you say, of transplantation not working. And he, from that moment, set about spending his life trying to solve this big problem of transplantation. And he identified that it was clearly because of the immune reaction, and then over the decades in which he was working, it was clear that it was because of differences we have in these genes. And he did find a way by which he could do transplantation irrespective of the versions of these genes that people have. So the way that he did that, it turns out that it only really works in animals, which is medically not very helpful, but it still gives us a deep insight into how it works. So what happens is if you expose the fetus of a mouse to cells from a different mouse, then when that fetus grows up to become an adult mouse, it is now tolerant to transplants from the mouse whose cells it was exposed to when it was very young.
In theory, that could work with humans, although we would never allow ethically such experimentation.
But it's not very useful because you can't start exposing human fetuses to cells. And even in these experiments, I'm not actually advocating any particular stance on the rights and wrongs of animal experiments. I'm just telling you what they did to get this knowledge. So what they did was, so when they did these experiments, the theory that fit with that was that when your immune system is developing, it learns what is self, what is part of you. And if it happens to see cells from another mouse, it doesn't know, it thinks that's part of self as well. But then as you get older, now it's tolerant to everything that it saw when it was developing, and then it can attack everything that's not self. So there's a sort of education process for the immune system to learn what's part of you when you're very young, and then afterwards it's able to attack anything that's not part of you. So as long as it was exposed to another mouse's cell when it was very young, then it then became tolerant to those cells later on.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa on Health. I'm John Schumann, sitting in for Rich Fisher. My guest today is Professor Dan Davis from the University of Manchester. He's written a new book that's just out from Oxford University Press called The Compatibility Gene. And Dan Davis, I was particularly intrigued by one of the characters in your story. And as I said, this book is really amazing in terms of its history of the field. But Eric Schat sprang to mind as quite a character. It was almost as though truth is stranger than fiction. Can you tell the listeners a little bit about his quite amazing story?
The first striking thing about Eric Schat is he's always wearing the same clothes every day, all the time, every time you see him. He has this sort of uniform of a short and a T-shirt. You know, it doesn't matter what the weather is, doesn't matter what the formality of the event is. He's always wearing the same. It's like he's telling you, I don't have time to think about what I'm going to wear. I'm just wearing this and we're done. Now let's get on with the important thing. And so that's great and that's clear and that's up front. And already you have an impression that, you know, there's something about this guy. So his big idea is really to embrace the complexity of genetics and use complicated computer analysis of how genes are coordinated and working in concert together. And then he talks about genes in the sort of language that you would normally have for electronic circuits, like hubs and nodes and connections and things like that for genes. So he's one of a handful of scientists there are, or a bunch of scientists there are, that are now trying to use what we know about genes and apply, you know, complex computational analysis and work out genetic circuitry of how genes are connected. So he's moving on from there's one gene, there's one cure for that one gene, and we'll be able to tackle the disease. You know, that hasn't worked out so well for many diseases. It's very complicated. And so he's now talking of complex genetic interactions as the thing that we have to study. And then you'll find hubs, you know, particular genes that network together the actions of other genes, and those will be the things to target with drugs. And also, with his kind of computational analysis, he can try to predict what the side effects might be for targeting different genes. One of the reasons that pharmaceutical companies struggle very often is because it's very, very hard to predict anything about the side effects that a drug might have, even if it's a perfectly if the drug is worked out perfect to target a particular protein or gene in you, it's very hard to predict what consequence that would have on the network of activity of all the other genes and proteins in you. And so he's trying to address this. And he's sort of part of a band of sort of new wave scientists trying to analyze the complexity of genetic interactions. And you know what? The funny thing is we don't know. We don't know if he's on the right path or not to get to new medicine. You know, this is right at the frontier of knowledge, and there's no, you know, you're going to have to wait 10, 20 years, and it'll either, you know, you'll look back and you'll say, well, that was brilliant, that got us onto the right path to produce a whole new raft of medicines, or we could look back and say, nah, that didn't quite work out because of this and that.
Moreover, his personal story, you mentioned his uniform, is so impressive and somewhat shocking, his humble beginnings and what he's been able to overcome, that in some ways you think this man must be destined for greatness if he's managed to make it as far as he has. I mean, he was basically expelled from his family.
That's right, yeah. So his personal story sort of set him up for being able to blaze a trail, if you like. You know, so that's what comes across in the book, that a lot of people, their approach to science, their approach to their research really comes, or you can see how their approach could come from aspects of their upbringing. And so in his case, there was he was brought up in a religious family, and he went to the army. The family had no interest in secular education at all. He wasn't encouraged to go to university at all. He went into the army, but then he injured his shoulder, and that forced him to leave the army. And when that happened, then he realized actually he didn't really have many friends in the army. He was a bit depressed, and he really felt that suddenly he found solace in thinking about more mathematical, computational things at university. And he says that his religious upbringing sort of gave him this desire to work on on the big picture, to work on big issues. And that, in combination with his newfound solace in deep computational analysis and mathematical thinking, got him started on this track for analyzing networks of genes. And then there was an episode where he was working for a company called Affymetrix, and it was a complicated situation where he was using software, but he tweaked the software to make it better for his own purposes. But a different company accused him from stealing some of that software from themselves. And it was a complicated situation where he obviously didn't do anything wrong, actually, but there was, even the FBI were called in to investigate whether he had stolen software. And in a sense, he was a hero for the academic community, because he was just trying to, you know, take commercial software and make it better for what he actually wanted to do scientifically. But, you know, it was hard on him, and there was a lot of pressure. You know, to get through that, you've got to have something of the right stuff about you. And then in the end, he was cleared, and his family came back to him. They actually celebrated his success, whereas before they felt that, you know, this secular work he was doing was of no real importance to them. So in the end, everything comes good. And, you know, he's got the strength of character now to get stuff done that's going against the grain.
So you hear this, you see these examples of giant science being done here, especially in this very complicated field, as you've alluded to, and then these incredible personalities that are forged under such different circumstances and different cultures and places. And one of the things that I never knew that surprised me about two very famous historical scientists was the rivalry between Robert Cook and Louis Pasteur. I had no idea they were such rivals. Do you?
Oh, yeah. So that really goes right back to the beginnings of working. Working out that there are germs, even that germs are causing disease. That there are minute things all around us. You know, what greater? There's no greater discovery than that. You know, it's so obvious to us. Germs cause disease. You know, and there's minute things in the air that can cause disease. So obvious that it's hard to imagine that was completely, you know, no one thought that. It was completely, someone had to discover that and prove it. And so that, it goes right back to that. And those two were rivals, you know, making snide comments to each other during lectures. And they both really together, contributed immensely, culminating in this idea that germs cause disease, which is one of the greatest discoveries surely of ever. How many lives have been saved just from that fact alone. The mind boggles. They were arch enemies in part because Pasteur's from France, not from Germany, so they came from, you know, those two countries were antagonistic at that time, so that sort of comes across perhaps in why they were personally dissing each other in lectures and stuff.
That was right. I was just kind of surprised at the ribaldry and I always think of those olden times as so much more formal, and it was funny to see them.
Yeah, that's what's quite interesting, that when you go through the history of science, I mean, it's just people. So, you know, the people are the same as the people now. So the same basic human emotions of jealousy, rivalry, and, you know, so I mean, you know, there are also stories where there's, you know, people really do bond in a team and they celebrate each other. You know, so there's all the spectrum of human emotion is there in the way science gets done, just like music, art, and every other aspect of human achievement. And that's also one of the things I really wanted to get across, that it takes all different kinds of people to do great science, and great science happens in all different kinds of ways, and it's very rarely, it's almost nothing to do with this sort of stereotypical, you know, bearded guy having a eureka moment, right? It's not like that. So there's endless numbers of ways by which great discoveries are made. Sometimes it's collegial between a group of people discussing something, or an experiment, or an accident, or, you know, or even antagonistic arguments between people that still lead us to great discoveries.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa on Health. I'm John Schumann, sitting in for Rich Fisher. My guest today is Professor Dan Davis, author of The Compatibility Gene, just released from Oxford University Press. He is a professor and the director of research at the University of Manchester. And you were describing how collaboration can occur across teams or across countries, or how sometimes rivalry can be the crucible of science. And perhaps there's no better model for studying immunology than HIV, the human immunodeficiency virus. And you cover a lot of that territory in the book and really opened my eyes to how some of the discoveries about how HIV affects humans really has led to major advances in our understanding of immunology, genetics, and how to fight HIV. And it's gone from a fatal illness to really a chronic disease. And in fact, what you opened my eyes to was a whole new category. I had heard of long-term non-progressors, that is, people who are afflicted with HIV but who don't seem to lose their immunity, their immune system, as most people affected with HIV do if they're not treated with medication. But there are these folks called HIV controllers, which I found to be a fascinating term. Can you describe or just tell us about that?
So basically, when you're infected with HIV, there's a variable period of time before you would get full-blown AIDS. And so you get infected with HIV, but each person would have a different time before they actually get the disease of AIDS. And that period of time, for some people, can be many, many years. Their immune system is able to control the HIV infection, the virus, and they don't develop AIDS. They don't lose the ability for their immune system to work properly, like you say. So when somebody can control the virus with their immune system for a very long period of time, 7 years or more, then those few people, about one in 300, I think, are called the HIV controllers. And so one of the fascinating studies to be done to look at that was in those HIV controllers, you know, what genes do they have that are different from everyone else? And it turns out that the top-ranked gene that's different in people that can control that virus is a particular version of the compatibility gene. Actually, there are a few particular versions that you could have that would protect you. So some people who have this sort of superpower of controlling this lethal virus with their immune system comes down to the fact that they have particular versions of these compatibility genes. But right there, the next question, you know, will be, well, why is that? And that's right at the frontier. So we don't really know that, actually. So we know a lot about what these genes do. Now, it takes me kind of 60 pages to really describe exactly how these genes work in the body. So you can get a really detailed knowledge of what the compatibility gene does in the immune system. And yet precisely why a particular version protects against HIV. There are good ideas about how that might work, but it isn't proven yet as to exactly why a particular version of the compatibility gene would protect you against HIV. And what's more, those versions of these genes that protect you against getting AIDS also make you slightly more susceptible to getting other kinds of diseases, like some kinds of autoimmune disease. So an extremely important message from all of that research is that there is no perfect set of compatibility genes. It's not that if you have these particular genes, they'll be really great for fighting all kinds of diseases. No. If you have a particular compatibility gene, you'll be better off at fighting HIV, but you'll be worse off at dealing with something else. So nobody has a perfect set of genes. So it's about having this diversity across all the population, all the different people, all of us have different versions of these genes. So at that level, the crucial thing is for humankind to have this great diversity in their genes, so as a population and as an individual, we're each able to fight all different kinds of diseases. And so that's an important message. That's one of the reasons why I wrote this book, because people would often generally think that things that are most different between people are things like hair color, eye color, or skin color. But what's really different between people are immune system genes, and we have to have that diversity. The whole system of humankind works by maintaining this exceptional diversity in immune system genes.
You touched on something a moment ago about autoimmune diseases, and I think no interview or discussion of immunology should go to completion without a discussion of our understanding of autoimmune diseases. These are conditions like lupus or rheumatoid arthritis that in which our understanding is that our own immune system turns against our own tissues and attacks and leads to illness and disease. And you mentioned how these HIV controllers may be more susceptible to illnesses like this. So how does that play into our understanding of the compatibility genes?
Right at the beginning of our discussion, remember we spoke about how Medawar discovered this way to deal with transplantation. That's because your immune system learns early on what's part of you, and now it becomes tolerant to everything that's part of you. It doesn't attack you. It's ready to attack other stuff. So that sounds very clear and fine. But of course, in reality, actually, it's a bit more fuzzy than that. Because, for example, during adolescence, your body starts making different kinds of things than it did when you were very young. Or if you get pregnant, there are different kinds of hormones being made, etc. So actually, it's a bit more fuzzy about how your body learns to not attack yourself and only attack germs. And in autoimmune diseases, the body just doesn't quite get it right, and it starts attacking parts of you by mistake, in effect. And so we do understand quite a lot about what happens during, once that has started, we understand what happens when your immune system starts attacking your body. For example, during in a version of diabetes, one of your immune cells start attacking the cells that produce insulin. And we understand what happens. But what we don't understand clearly is how an autoimmune gets started. So we can't predict yet who's going to get an autoimmune disease, but because we don't understand exactly how they start off. But even so, a clue to some of that is the fact that the version of these compatibility genes that you have does correlate with a slight increase in the risk you might have for particular kinds of autoimmune diseases.
Dan Davis is a professor at the University of Manchester, where he's the director of research for the Collaborative Center for Inflammation Research, and he's the author of The Compatibility Gene, brand new from Oxford University Press. Well, that's our show for today. Studio Tulsa on Health is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. Views of our guests are their own and do not necessarily represent those of KWGS or the University of Tulsa. If you've missed a recent show, you can listen from our archive anytime. Just click on Studio Tulsa under the Program tab at our website, publicradiotulsa.org. I'm John Schumann, sitting in for Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.